Ernest, what's up? Look, I want to put you onto something that's been making waves in the personal finance world. If you've been relying on Mint to manage your finances, I got some news that might startle you at first. Mint is no more. But hold on, because every cloud has its silver lining, and in this case, that lining is Monarch Money. For those of us searching for a robust, user-friendly alternative, Monarch Money is stepping up to the plate. And from personal experience, it's hitting a home run. Let's get personal for a moment. Managing finances can be a maze of confusion, stress, and time consumption. Believe me, I've been there, jumping from one finance app to another, hoping to find that one platform that simplifies everything. Then came Monarch Money. Its ease of use, powerful features, and sleek design transformed my approach to managing finances. What truly sets Monarch apart for me, though, is its collaboration feature. With money being a top Discord trigger for many couples, the ability to seamlessly manage finances with my wife has been a game changer. No extra costs, just shared goals and clarity. But Monarch isn't just about managing your current finances, it's about building your future. Saving for that dream house, your wedding, or a once-in-a-lifetime vacation becomes not just a possibility, but a reality with Monarch's intuitive tools. It's no wonder the Wall Street Journal held it as the best app for savings growth. Monarch Money represents the next evolution in personal finance apps. It's an ad-free haven where your experience is the priority, constantly refined based on real user feedback. It's everything we've been asking for: intuitive, powerful, and relentlessly focused on user satisfaction. Now, for a bit more practicality, Monarch makes transitioning from Mint a breeze, ensuring you can bring all your tags and categories with you. Its intuitive design, customization options, and commitment to privacy and an ad-free experience make it stand out in the sea of competitors. Look, after trying out Monarch for myself, I understand why it's the top-rated personal finance app. And right now, get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/leisure. That's MONARCHMONEY.com/leisure for your extended 30-day free trial. Earners, what's up? Look, I want to give y'all a little peek behind the curtain of producing Earn Your Leisure. It's a lot more than just sitting down and chatting. It involves meticulous planning, recording, editing, and then promoting each episode to ensure it reaches all of you. And if you picked up any of our merch, then you know there's a whole extra layer of logistics, from inventory management to shipping. Running a podcast is like running a small business. And speaking of business, I know many of you entrepreneurs are involved in e-commerce. You understand how crucial it is to streamline operations and cut costs wherever possible. That's why I want to talk to you about ShipStation, the multi-carrier shipping solution that integrates seamlessly with all your online sales channels. It's all about optimizing your shipping, connecting with expert partners, and freeing up more of your time to focus on scaling your business. Now let's talk about our experience with ShipStation. This tool has been a game changer for us, especially with automating routine tasks. Being able to manage everything from one dashboard and print shipping labels with just a click, absolute lifesavers. Plus, the discounts we get on shipping costs are incredible. Honestly, it feels like we're saving thousands. And as our show and merch sales have grown, ShipStation's robust automation and reporting features have helped us keep up without missing a beat. For those of you who get overwhelmed by order volumes, ShipStation's easy-to-use dashboard is a dream come true. You can import orders from any sales channel, apply shipping preferences automatically, and handle customer service issues right there. Not to mention the savings with up to 89% off carrier rates like UPS, DHL Express, and USPS. It's no wonder over 130,000 companies stick with ShipStation long term. So, are you ready to turn your shipping challenges into growth opportunities? Head over to ShipStation.com and use promo code EARN for a free 60-day trial. Again, that's ShipStation.com, promo code EARN. Start streamlining your shipping and scaling your business today.
The time has come, ladies and gentlemen.
InvestFest, that's right.
That's right. InvestFest 2023 is here.
August 25th, 26th, and 27th in Atlanta, Georgia. We are taking it to a new level. Bigger than ever this year, we're going to do 20,000 people in Atlanta, Georgia.
I want you to do yourself a favor. Head over to investfest.com right now.
We will have activations from Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. 3 days, musical performances, billionaires. Everything is going to be a completely life-changing experience. Vendor Marketplace, Food Truck Village, you know how we do.
Don't wait. Don't hesitate. Head over now.
All right, guys. Welcome back. EYL, we back home.
Yes.
In the lab. This is an interview that we've been trying to actually do for a while. So, if you follow us, you know that we are foodies. We frequent the restaurants a lot. And the number one restaurant in New York that we always go to all the time. I just had my birthday dinner there, actually. Yeah. Brooklyn Chop House.
Yes.
So Brooklyn Chop House, the first location was downtown Manhattan by the Brooklyn Bridge.
Yeah, Battery Park?
It's actually FIDE, so it's across the street from Pace University, and right at the mouth of the Brooklyn Bridge.
Got you.
So we call that Financial District, FIDE for short, Financial District.
That was the first location, and then once they opened a second location in Times Square.
Yeah.
And that's the one that we've been turning up a lot, all the time. I've been in there every week, pretty much.
Good looking.
No problem.
One of the owners of Brooklyn Chop House is Don Poole. So I forgot who was the first person to introduce us. I'm not sure.
I think Matt was mentioned trying to connect us like years ago.
But then we had Matt. And then over the last 6 months, we've actually been running into each other everywhere.
You've been part of the tour.
Yeah, I've been on tour with you guys. You guys went a little harder than me, but you know, but I've seen you guys maybe, I don't know, 8-10 times in the last, I don't know, over the, whether it's weekends, weekdays, events, you know, important events, you know, in industry, fashion, film. I've seen you guys, I don't know, 10 times in the last, like, 12 weeks.
Yeah, man. Minimum. Everywhere.
Minimum.
From Dubai to Super Bowl.
Miami.
Dubai. Yeah. Super Bowl.
We've been all over the world together.
Sick. L.A. Grammys.
Grammys. That's a fact.
Impromptu.
It's a fact.
Meeting the other day. I even know you guys were coming.
Mary J. Blige.
Shout out to 4040 Angie.
Shout out to Mary J. Blige and Angie Martinez.
Yeah.
Congrats, Mary, on your new show.
Yes,
congrats.
Yes.
So this is going to be a dope episode because we're not only going to talk about his journey as being a restaurateur, but he's also a music man as well. That's actually how he got his start.
Mm-hmm.
And both of those albums are people that he actually played an intricate role in, from Mary J. Blige to Notorious B.I.G.
Fox Boog.
Boogie. We got to get that Fox Boog album. The Il Nana album.
The Il Nana LP is on the way. I'm going to put it next to Hardcore just because of cultural impact.
Oh, yeah.
You got to do
both
it.
Both of them. They're side by side.
And it's Brooklyn, right?
Yeah. Both cultural importance and then both Brooklyn.
There you go.
Brooklyn. So this is going to be a dope episode. We're going to go through his whole journey. We're going to talk about the ups and downs, entrepreneurship, the music business, restaurant business, and everything. But before we start, thank you for joining us, bro. Appreciate it.
Oh, man. Thank you for having me, man. I've been trying to connect with you guys as well. And I'm, you know, proud of what you guys have been doing and the message and, you know, everything, you know, that you guys have been actually integral in trying to educate people on, again, you know, the slogan assets over liability. So I think, you know, hopefully the message is resonating out there in the community where it needs to resonate at.
That's a fact.
Thank you. And you're part of the Sky Dweller Club. So
yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. You
know, the Rose Gold
edition.
I love it.
That's my thing. So asset again.
That's a fact.
Another fact.
That's a fact. So let's get into this. So, all right. Where does it start for you? Because I know it starts a long time ago.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about the start. Let's talk about the music and how you got going.
Yeah, so my passion's always been music. Just as a kid, you know, I had all of these images, all of the, you know, like from Right On magazine, I had all those guys on my wall. And, you know, I used to take piano lessons as a kid. I hated it, but my parents forced me to do it. And you know what? It ended up working out in a weird way later on in life because, you know, I had an ear for music. And, you know, I got my shot by, you know, actually going on the road with the Notorious B.I.G., Biggie. And prior to that, you know, I had went to Howard University for a little bit. And I met Puffy, you know, Harpierre. you know, my good friend Mark Pitts, Derek Angeletti, they were all down there. You know, didn't know that, you know, music business was going to be their future. They were, you know, at Howard studying, you know, taking up business and whatever, you know, they were doing. But just so happened that Puff, you know, kind of took, like, left and was interning, got an internship job. And I'm going to talk about that later on, how important that was. But he got an internship job at Uptown, and then he became cool with, like, Heavy D. He was cool with, like, Dougie Fresh and a lot of those guys. And when it came time for homecoming, he would bring Heavy D down. And then, you know, he always, like, try to learn the game. And then he became an A&R, and he started working with Heavy D as an A&R. Well, Uptown is an A&R, so he was producing Heavy A&R and Heavy D, right? And then, you know, he got his shot to, you know, A&R Jodeci, obviously Mary J. Blige, and Father MC, and a couple other people. So, you know, it was inspiring to see him go from intern to A&R to vice president A&R to then, you know, obviously, you know, they had a conflict, and then, you know, he got fired from his job. Then he went and started his own label. So that whole entrepreneurial, he then took his entrepreneurial journey. So, you know, it inspired me. So to answer your question, how I got my start was really once my friend Mark started to manage Biggie, I kind of said, you know what? I want to learn from that same perspective. I want to get on the road. You ain't got to pay me nothing. I just want to learn the game and understand the game from a management perspective. And that's how I became part of his, you know, his management team. And I was on the road with him, and then we hit it off and became good friends.
What year was that?
That was 1994.
So you was like an understudy for Biggie's management.
Correct, yeah, so correct.
Mark Pitts, that's how I learned the game. Mark Pitts has Big. Later he gets Usher.
No, he had Biggie. He had Faith. He had a group called Changing Faces.
Yes.
And that was the core of his management team. And then he went on later on from there to, you know, do A&R and, you know, obviously, you know, work with Usher and Chris Brown and so on and so forth, and, you know, make historic moves. So, but his first interest in the game was, you know, he was working with Puff, and then Biggie asked him to manage him. And then through that, I got my entrance into, you know, working on management. And then I was always, you know, doing the entrepreneur thing. So I opened up a barbershop in Brooklyn called Moods. So it was on Washington Avenue, not too far from where Biggie grew up. So they would come through, you know, stop by, and everybody in the neighborhood was like, oh, shoot, you know, Biggie, da da da. So then a friend of mine, his name is Anton, and his brother Gavin, they had a little sister called Inga, and they used to get their hair cut there. So it was like, hey, my sister, her name, you know, she was signed to Capitol Records, but it didn't work out through, you know, another situation. It was like, hey, you know, I want to introduce you. Maybe you guys could, you know, work together. I met her. We hit it off. You know, I started, you know, going around and doing demos. So I went to this kid, Dr. Period. He was a producer in Brooklyn who produced like Smooth the Hustler and Trigger the Gambler. Ooh. Yeah, and then Clark Kent, he helped me with a lot of music. And a few other people. So I leaned on all the relationships I knew and everyone I knew through Big. And we started, you know, putting a demo together. And then we got a big break. So that was my first client on my own, right? Mm-hmm. So no, we had no deal. So we got our big break by getting on LL's album on a record called I Shot You. Mm-hmm. So that record featured Keith Murray,
Prodigy,
Fat Joe, and LL. And there was one more spot. I think they was trying to get another artist. The artist didn't show up or whatever. So Trackmasters, who was cool with Anton, said, hey, we heard, you know, you putting your demo together. And we started hitting mixtapes too, right? We started doing like Clue tapes, and we was doing the groundwork, right? So next thing, they call us, we went in the studio, we laid the 16, and then they played it for L said, bet, leave it on there. That actually sounds dope. And she had this like unique kind of deep tone voice. There was like, you know, kind of like at that moment, they were saying that she sounded like Shaheen from Wu-Tang. Right. But
the rugged
style. She had her own style, and you know, we came with a little, you know, a different, more edgier lyrics. A little different than what was out there before.
Yeah.
And that's how, you know, And once that hit, it was a bidding war, an unbelievable bidding war. We ended up going with Def Jam.
Can we stop right there?
Yeah.
Because this is interesting, right? I never heard this story, right? So Inga obviously is Foxy Brown.
Right.
She's from Brooklyn.
Yes.
But she does the song with LL.
Yep.
She jumps on the Ain't No with Jay.
Yep, that's after.
But she runs with the Queens Crew with Nas.
So that's after.
What happened here?
Okay, so it was a unique dynamic. That was actually a great question because she was part of different crews. So after the I Shot You record, Jay-Z calls me, right? He's like, I'm putting out this independent joint through Priority and something. It was like a mix of a couple of different labels. And I heard your girl. I want to put on this record. So I meet him. True story. And we talked about it the last time I seen him at Fort. No, I actually saw him in L.A. when we was at that
Rock Nation.
The Rock Nation Run.
Yeah, yeah. So he said, yeah, I want to put it on there. He was like, what's it going to take? I was like, we're going to work it out. He's like, all right, I'm going to bring it back. Right, because we were sizzling, doing a couple of things, so we end up getting 1250. I remember the number. Right, he came with $1,250.
$1,250.
$1,250.
Oh, okay. I thought it was $12,000.
No. $1,250. This is early. This is early '90s.
Okay. Big man.
We early. Right. So I meet him at Junior's. He pulled up in the GS Lexus. I had a Lexus too. So we met. We said, "Yo, we're gonna do it at D&D Studios. We're gonna knock this verse out in about another week." So this is the beat. So I gave her the beat. She started, writing her rhymes, and that's how she ended up getting on Ain't No.
So that's all he paid was $1,250. That's it?
Right. I mean, he was independent. He was from Brooklyn. So we had people in common. So, we just...
And she was
high.
Coming up.
Yeah.
But she wasn't...
She's not who
an artist.
Yeah. She wasn't right. She wasn't there yet. We had this one feature, but we were like buzzing in the streets.
Yeah.
Then the same thing happened. We get a call from Kenny Smoove, who's from up this way. He had a label through a situation. I think it was through Def Jam, and he asked us to jump on this record called "Touch Me, Tease Me."
Yeah.
Right. Like I got this call up next week.
The kid from Mount Vernon.
Right. Case.
Yeah.
Case. So
Marry on that too.
Correct. So this is how, this is when I really met Mary. And then that record started to blow up, right? And then because it was on Def Jam, they added that to the Nutty Professor soundtrack.
Yep.
And then it was like, who's this Jay-Z guy? I want to meet him. So I'm the one who introduced Jay-Z and Dame Dash to Leor, right? So once I introduced them to Leor, they went and, Leor wanted to kind of take the record. He was like, yo, this record out here has Foxy Brown on it, and it wasn't cleared. Ain't No wasn't cleared. It's like, we need to clear it. Mm. So, they was going back and forth a little bit, and then what ended up happening is we all had a meeting, and then they agreed to, work it out financially, clear the record for Jay's album, and also add the record to the Nutty Professor soundtrack simultaneously, which worked to both of their advantages.
Yeah.
So then they end up after that, the success of that record and that soundtrack, and then Jay dropping the album and becoming successful on his own, they end up working out a deal to do a joint venture with Def Jam and Rockefeller.
That's 96. Because Case, when he dropped that record, it's crazy. He actually came to our high school to perform it.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, I was sick. I didn't go to school that day. They probably like, yo, Case did the record. I'm like, because... It's not CL and Aaron. They were doing Wise Projects, and that was part of it. They brought them to the school. That was crazy.
Yeah. So what ended up happening is after he got the deal, his album came out in '96,
yep.
Right? His second album was on Def Jam. So first album '96 independent, and then we came out with my artist. We came out in '96 in November.
So you're managing Foxy full time.
Foxy solely.
You're her sole manager.
Sole manager.
All right, so obviously her career starts to take off, and now that leads to other clients. Where do you start working with Mary?
So after '96, I started working with Foxy. The album blew up, so we did that album. Then we did another album, China Doll.
Hmm.
Then that album blows up. That goes number one. That's like '99. And then I decided to go into, I got a call that they were looking for executive vice president of A&R. So I decided to go that direction and do more of the A&R, more of my passion of making music. Because even though I was managing, you know, I'll contribute to records here and there, ideas, you know, concepts. And I decided to go into become the executive vice president of the A&R for MCA Records. And they also gave me a label deal for my company. My artist didn't blow up, but, you know, I took a shot at it. And also, as part of that, the first, their biggest artist on the label was Mary J. Blige. So they said, you know what, you have a history of working with, you know, successful artists, and, you know, we like you to work with us. So that then, you know, we got together at that point, and I worked on our No More Drama album.
So, okay. So the role of a manager, let's go through this.
Mm-hmm.
What's the responsibilities day to day for a manager, for a musician?
Just one other question that you was talking about Nas. You want to get back to
Nas? Yeah.
Let's not skip the Nas part.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Nas. Okay. Let's get to that. So Foxy, she's running with the firm.
Right, so so she got the Jay-Z out record out. She's working on her album, and then she always had she loved Nas from the beginning, for when he dropped his album, '92.
As a fan,
right? So Trackmasters, right? And Steve Stout was working with Nas. So Steve was managing Nas, and Trackmasters was producing Nas. So Trackmasters is the one that gave us our opportunity to get on the LL record, right? So naturally, we're all, you know, working and developing, and then Trackmasters also executive producing the first album as well. So, you know, collectively, we're all working together. Her, Nas, and AZ get together, and Carmega, and they say, you know what, we're going to start this thing called a firm. We're going to start our own, you know, power group. Individually, they were artists separately. So which made it kind of cool. They didn't come together as a group first.
Yeah.
Nas was Nas, Foxy was getting hot, AZ was AZ, and they came together to form this group, the firm. And then, you know, they started working on records. So Affirmative Action was the first record that they did together on Nas' album.
It was written.
Yeah, I mean, she was, you know, I helped her with that verse too, by the way.
What?
Yeah.
Did you?
Yeah.
You wrote some of
it? Well, I helped her with it.
She helped.
I'm not going to take her credit away.
She had Rhyme of the Month in the source for that.
Yeah. So,
congrats.
So, yeah, we collaborated. Just put it that way. So, so after that, they end up doing a deal with Trackmasters and Aftermath.
Aftermath, right?
Trey. End up getting together and do a collaboration. Then I was able to help, like, co-executive produced that album with, you know, Trackmaster.
Firm album.
The Firm album.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Dope.
So that was, you know.
What's your favorite song on the Firm album?
I think it might be Firm Biz.
Firm Biz.
Really?
Yeah. That's a good one. That was the lead. That was the lead single.
I didn't think that should have been.
Bone Tap, I think, is definitely up there.
Bone Tap
was gangster. I was going to say.
I like the song with Nori, too.
That's crazy.
Nori Know This. Nori Know That.
Nori goes on to being like the NOI.
We spoke about Nori. Nori said that song actually saved his life.
Wow.
We spoke about that on Drink Champ because he was saying that he was down and out, and it was after the war report came out and Capone was locked up, and he was like, he was back in the hood. He ain't had no money. He didn't have any direction. And Jungle was like, yo, you wanted to get on this record? He was like, he flew to Miami. He did the record. And I think it was originally supposed to be for Nature's album or something.
Right.
And then he was like, and it landed on the Firm album. And then it was like his solo career just took off after that.
That's dope, man. That's dope. That's a great story. I got to talk about that when I go to Miami. Check. You got to talk about that one.
Shout out to Nori, man.
Shout out to Nori, bro.
Very nostalgic to our childhood, these conversations. So, all right. So the manager, right? Because we always say about the role of a manager. I personally didn't know how important, because I was always one of those people like, no need for a manager. You could just do it yourself, until we actually were in a position where we needed a manager. And then I saw how much work that entails and how it just can bog you down. And I don't think people fully realize it until they actually need it. So what's the role of a manager?
So the most important thing, especially from an artist manager's perspective, is representation, right? You don't want to negotiate all of your own deals, right? So you have a manager, you have an agent, if you know you need an agent to secure bookings that has other buyers, you know, in their database to secure bookings. And obviously the entertainment lawyer, you know, you have the road manager, but the key, the nucleus of it is the manager, because they deal with all of those different positions, as well as the stylist, as well as the label, as well as the publishing company, as well as the publicist if you have one. So that's the nucleus of all, you know, working with the artist to make sure that all the functions that an artist needs are done and done correctly and done on time and schedule, and make sure that they have everything they need to be successful, because that's the last thing an artist wants to worry about, all of those other things. So a manager is key to putting, you know, negotiating deals, you know, doing day to day, you know, back in the days, you know, when you're bigger, you have a management company and you have a day to day manager. Back in the days, we were everything. We were the manager, the day to day, the role manager. We did it all in the beginning, because you got to work your way up to build your organization to have, you know, that foundation.
So as you're growing, right, the records are blowing up, your artists are blowing up, you have the label. Obviously, you said your artists didn't blow like you thought, but you're still getting money at this time.
Right, right.
Are you continuing the entrepreneurial journey? Because I feel like the barbershop happens, but then at some point, franchising happens.
Right.
What period is this? Because I know it starts at Papa John's, something like that, right?
Right, so barbershop I had when I was rocking with Big earlier on, before I had Foxy, and then when I had Foxy, I sold the barbershop. Because I then, you know, we then started getting some success, and she became, worldwide artist. So at that point, I said, you know what? I want to, you know, kind of, you know, start my own label. So my first entrepreneurial, you know, attempt was doing my own label, mm-hmm. right? So, and then doing my own, well, actually doing my own management company and label. So I also discovered Shine. Mm-hmm. So I found Shine in the midst of, right before I did the deal with MCA, I found Shine. You know, he was at a barbershop. My boy Manny and another guy, Austin, brought him to me. It was like, you know, I know you got Foxy, you know, like this kid, we think he's dope. So he spit for me for like 2 hours. I was like, all right, we're gonna figure this out.
Let's go to
and then did you mention Matt early on? You said Matt was the one that tried to hook us up.
Different Matt.
So there was an attorney that
Matt Middleton
was down at.
I saw him at the Rock Nation brunch.
Yeah, that was down at Howard, and then he was actually doing some I think assistant DA work, and then I said I got a client. I know you could do this that needs a manager, so I brought Shine to Matt. Right, Matt represented him. Oh, I already had an attorney, and then we end up doing the deal. We end up signing the deal in the back of my car. So, but prior to that, me signing him, right? So once I found him, he started to move around. He started to do a few things. So he actually bumped into Jay-Z and gave Jay-Z a demo. Jay listened to it, said, it's all right. And he was like, it's all right. And he took back the demo. Like, it's the weirdest thing. They spoke about this too, right? I'm like, yo, why you take back your demo from Jay? Nah, he don't think that I'm it. So that was an interesting story. And then along the way, a few other, as I have him sign, I have a meeting with Diddy. Diddy falls in love with it. And then Def Jam falls in love with it. And then, so it turned into another bidding war. Then we end up doing. I end up doing a deal with Puff, with Bad Boy, where he went to Bad Boy. And then, you know, I got my deal separate from Bad Boy, like, you know, override points and stuff like that. So he went directly there, and I kind of, it's almost like he was signed to me, but I kind of like released him to Puff.
Yeah, I feel like this Howard 91 through 93. There needs to be a documentary on the people who came out of that.
We spoke to Sean. You know what's it's a good story about this Matt Middleton thing that I'll just kind of interject. So Matt Middleton, before I did this, I was a financial advisor mm-hmm. for 12 years. And when I was first starting as a financial advisor, I used to get like all of these publications, Black Enterprise, all these like any black like business publication I would get. And you know, they always have the list of top 50 business accountants. top 50 lawyers, top 50, whatever. So he was on a list. So I emailed every single person on the list. I didn't know any of them.
Right.
I just emailed them like, hey, I'm a financial advisor, you know, would love to, you know, come and just, you know, have a meeting with you if you're interested. And he actually was one of the few people that responded. He's like, yeah, come up. So I met him in his office, like a cold call. I didn't know who he was. He didn't know who I was. And we sat and we had a meeting. And he was telling me, I think at the time he was representing Cameron.
Right.
And a few other people. He had like clients. And he was the president of this organization called Beasler, Black Entertainment Lawyer something. And so it was crazy because fast forward almost 15 years later, I see him at the Rock Nation brunch. He's like, yo, I'm like, remember that time? He's like, yeah, that was crazy. Like, you know, but I say that to say, you never know.
You never know. You never know who's who. And I like the fact that he answered though that.
Yeah.
I like that. That means a lot. Sometimes I would do that a lot. I couldn't do it to everyone.
Yeah.
I would do it a lot. And I met a few people later on in life, like, yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah. They say, thank you for you know, taking my call and, you know, inspiring me. So you never know who you're going to talk to along the way.
That's what I said. Even listen to this story right now, like that HBCU connection, right? Obviously, the big manager.
Yep.
You met at Howard. You know,
yep.
Matt.
Yep.
Howard.
Yep.
You brought Shine the Puff. Howard.
Yep.
It's just. I mean, I don't know how many guys graduated from it, but I know that the guys in the early 90s that were there, they obviously went in different aspects of their careers, but everybody, when they needed somebody, they looked to those people to, all right.
Yeah, look to that network. Yep. Yeah. And not only that, I thought that Matt could actually handle the client, right. Like in which he did. And he ended up, I believe that was his first client. And then from there, you know, he had endless clients and, you know, doing lots of different things, so that was good. And shout out to, you mentioned Cameron. Shout out to Cameron. Cameron, you know, just recently spoke about me giving him his first check. So that's another one I identified and I tried to sign, but he ended up going with Entertainment because they got a big bag from Sony. My bag was still little.
So it was him and Charlie Baltimore.
Yep. But before that, I was trying to sign him, and then I had gave him a check for, you know, doing a collaboration on, I ended up signing Foxy's brother, Gavin, his name was Pretty Boy.
Yeah.
And we did a deal at Sony and he ended up doing, you know, some collaboration and some writing on the album for me. So I gave him a check before he even got signed. So that was his first check he got, and Fab as well. So I identified Fab even before, like he was like buzzing on mixtapes with Clue. And I also gave him a check to come and collab with my artist like early on.
But collab. He's getting,
yeah.
Yeah. Keyword.
Yeah, collab. So, you know.
That's dope. Dope.
For the right price, I could even make your shit tighter.
So you're rocking and rolling in the music business, but at some point, the music business starts to die, I guess, when iTunes comes out.
It's more Napster. You know, downloading and, you know, file
streaming.
And just, you know, just ability to like, you know, like how the mixtapes was a source of promotion and marketing and you leaked what you wanted to the mixtapes or whatever. But now, you know, all entire albums were getting leaked and emailed. And, you know, it was that time where you could, you know, share files and then all of a sudden people got the bootleg of different albums. So it was hurting the music industry. So that was in like 2003 after I had been with MCA from 99 to 2003. I decided, and I had some success with working with Mary, and you know, we gained a great working relationship, and you know, shout out to her. I still work with her today. So that was another, you know, relationship that, you know, I'd garnered from, you know, the music business and the success of us having, you know, her album being successful. So then I decided to diversify and go into franchising. So it was something that, you know, I thought made sense because they had proven systems. And if I was going to invest my money, I wanted to invest it in something that had a system instead of a restaurant specifically, because restaurants are risky. And you know, it's a high risk investment. So, you know, 60 to 70% fail in the first, you know, year to 18 months, and then another 80% don't even make it to 3 years. So, it's definitely a high risk. So, I don't know why I like to take on the most riskiest of things, but I end up doing franchising. So I got into Papa John's Pizza, did a development 16-store development deal for New York City. Me and a partner of mine who introduced me to the opportunity, my boy Kev, and then we end up doing 7 out of them and then sold them all. Then he went on to do another franchise, and then I went on to get a franchise deal, a development deal with IHOP.
So for the development deal, how does this work? You go to the company and say, this is my idea to create more stores inside of, like, let's say, the borough of Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. Do they look at your plans? They okay it? They say yes or no? How does this work?
So another great question. So not exactly. So they have territories that they think are great, right? So when you go sit with them, they'll say, if another franchisor doesn't own that development right already, they'll say, well, we have Brooklyn, we have the Bronx, we have White Plains, we have, you know, this part of Jersey that we want to develop. If you have any interest, you know, and you qualify based on having restaurant experience and having, you know, the financial experience, I mean, financial wherewithal to do it, which we'll get into in a minute. We would love to have you develop the, you know, we feel that this amount of restaurants could fit in this territory. So in Brooklyn, we feel like a whole, you know, 6 stores, you do a, you know, 5-store, 6-store deal, and you could, you know, have options later. And then you get a certain amount of time to develop each store. Like maybe one, you have to build one every 2 years, right? For the next, you do a 5-store deal, one every 2 years for 10 years. And then, you know, but until then, that territory is locked and you own that development, what they call development area. And you own that development area until you finish your development deal.
Nobody can come on that.
Nobody can develop there. Gotcha. So unless you default, obviously, and you don't meet your, you know, your timeline, then it becomes available again.
But is it very cash intensive?
Very cash intensive, especially up front, because obviously restaurants and especially full service restaurants like that take, you know, quite some capital to, you know, build out, you know. You're talking 7 figures to build a restaurant of that size, 5,000 square feet, and everything that comes with it, right? So from the soft cost, the construction, the franchise fees, you know, training, everything that goes with it. So, but again, they have proven system. It's a, you know, for me, there was a void, you know, just going into the business side of it, why I did it was a void in a market, right? I grew up in Brooklyn, and there was only one IHOP in Brooklyn. It's like 3 million people. So I'm like, this is not making sense. So as a kid, I would have to go to the suburbs to get like Red Lobster and IHOP, and there was nothing in the, like, in the boroughs. There was nothing in Brooklyn. It was crazy to me, right? So I said, you know what? I'm gonna bring this because everyone loves it. Why is it not here? So I almost thought I didn't know what I was doing. Right, because I'm like, why isn't it here?
Like, what's the catch?
Right. I'm like, somebody, you know, knows something. I was going to this place in the 70s, and it's still one there. And we're in the, you know, 2000s, right? So they had like a 30-year run. So, you know, we took it on, we opened it up, and that restaurant became one of the highest grossing restaurants in 2007 of all 1,800 IHOPs, because I knew that. That's a value play, right? So by having a value brand in a place like Brooklyn, where it's a value market, it worked. The two worked really.
What part of Brooklyn was it in?
Downtown Brooklyn on Livingston Street. It's still there.
Still there.
I actually moved it across the street. Actually, the first one I built, they demoed the building and built another building. So I actually moved it across the street.
You still have ownership of it?
Yes, still on it.
So, all right, so let's get back to this Papa John's situation. Why'd you sell the Papa John's?
So Papa John's, it was at one point we had a really good performing unit, and then we had a couple that weren't performing that well. So me and my partner decided, you know what, we like, there was a couple of other brands that we thought can perform better for the amount of investment that we put in. Mm-hmm. The amount of return we were getting back, we said, you know what, let's maybe it's a good time. And we and someone, you know, made an offer to us that was really good. So we said, you know what? This was great. We built out this many. We didn't finish our development deal. So we sold the rights plus the remaining rights to develop. Yeah. And then we both decided he went in to do Popeyes and I went in to do IHOP.
Yeah, so I'm looking at it from a just from a business standpoint. If I'm doing Papa John's, I know my biggest competitor is Domino's.
Right.
But if I do IHOP, what's my biggest competitor?
In this market, it wasn't any. But in the rest of the country, there are competitors. Plenty, right? There's Denny's. Cracker Barrel, there's Denny's, yeah. There's Perkins. There's different in other markets. But in this market, right. I knew I had nobody close.
Yeah.
There was no one. There was the closest person was 10 years away from developing a market. And they still, in my opinion, still couldn't beat the IHOP brand and what, you know, IHOP meant to families that grew up on it.
So, inside of the franchise itself, were you able to create a uniqueness to the actual store, or did you have to abide by like, yo, this is the rule book for how we want our franchises?
Some great questions, bro. Oh man. So with that said, there is a franchise brand. It's franchise manual. There's what they call standard operating procedures, right? That you got to follow by when you're developing the brand, but because the way they developed earlier on was a standard blue roof, kind of freestanding IHOPs, which everyone knows when they see it, you know, whether you're anywhere in the country. But now they were doing non-traditional locations, which I found, which in Brooklyn, you really can't find the land downtown. So you had to do an inline, non-traditional. So with that said, and they realized that I had this music background, we tied in a little bit of the artwork was Brooklyn inspired. So we had like Brooklyn inspired Brooklyn Bridge, downtown Brooklyn artwork. So we kind of tied the brand to the community in a way. Did like some music inspired artwork. Obviously we had the brand's images inside, but they did allow me to do something unique and different. You know, I put at that time flat screens had just come out maybe like 5 or 6 years before. So I had a flat screen TV. I built not a VIP room, but like a meeting room, right? Inside of this location where people downtown and all of the businesses downtown could do breakfast meetings. Mm. So I did something a little different than what was traditional, and they allowed me to be creative within, you know, my ideas that I had. So that also worked really well.
So how much is it for the licensing fee for a franchise IHOP?
So a single unit is $50,000. And if you do a development deal, it's $40,000 per. And when you do a development deal, you pay for the first one and then you pay for halves of the other ones. And then you pay the other half each time you open the last one.
And that's what you did, a development deal?
Yeah, I did a development
deal. How many did you open?
I opened four.
All in Brooklyn?
All in Brooklyn.
They're still all running?
All running. Yeah. I own them all.
What parts of Brooklyn?
It's in downtown Brooklyn. It's in Flatbush, Brooklyn. It's in Coney Island. I had the license and I sublicensed that out to a friend of mine. Shout out to him. And then I have Williamsburg, Bushwick. Mm. So that's on Flushing Avenue. One's on Church Avenue, the other one's on Livingston.
Was the original deal for four, or was there more? And you said, I have the capacity to do four.
No, the original deal for four, I fulfilled the agreement. And then I replaced one as well. So that technically was the fourth one, and I licensed that one. That was the fifth one. But the replacement of the first one to the newer version was like, so I actually built, that's actually like building two restaurants.
So when you see the success of the four that you've done, was expansion part of the plan? Like, are we going to other boroughs?
I was thinking about it, but as I was, you know, got to the end, I thought, you know, let's try my own brand. Mm. Let's try something different, right? Let me, you know, the natural progression is going into real estate, which I'm doing that as well. But before I got there, I decided to try my own brand.
And this is when Brooklyn Chop House comes into play.
Yeah, it's from Brooklyn Chop House. Like 10 years later, Brooklyn Chop House came. Well, yeah, 10 years later, 07, yeah, 2018.
So I want to talk about Brooklyn Chop House. Before we get to Brooklyn Chop House, the IHOP. So all of this that you're funding, Are you funding this out of your pocket? Are you getting bank lines of credit? Are you have partners? Like,
great question again. So initially it was myself and a partner, my partner Dave Diamond Costa was my partner. He actually passed away, but we started it together. We had an idea. Someone brought us, you know, after I got out of Papa John's, I'm skipping a part. I actually opened a nightclub called Rain in Brooklyn, me and Dave. And then we went on to do the first two IHOPs. And what we did was, yes, we pulled together our resources. And then we had one more option, which is not as available today as it was before. We did like an equipment financing loan through like GE. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like there's a GE Franchise Financial. I don't know if they're still around today. Offer like equipment loans. So whatever we used that for the equipment, and then we used our money to build the rest.
So prior to Papa John's, prior to IHOP, did you have any experience in the restaurant tour like game at all? Or is the capital, let me partner with somebody who has that expertise?
No, I just knew business, right? So prior to doing Papa John's, I just knew that I wanted to own my own business, okay, right? By having my own management company, by having my own, you know, label imprint, I said, you know what, let me take a shot at it, because franchising, you can actually go. So I went to training to learn how to run the franchise, how to make the food, how to do food costs, how to do, you know, scheduling, labor, you know, build the restaurant. Basically, they teach you everything in training, right? And I already know how to build, because I used to renovate homes here and there, mm-hmm, and do that. So I already knew construction. So that part came easy.
Mm. And then you said it was a 10-year span between the IHOP and then obviously Brooklyn Chop House. Mm-hmm. What role is music in the music industry playing during that 10 years? Are you still involved?
Yeah, I still have my relationships. Still.
Earners, what's going on? Listen, EYLU is relaunching, revamping, retooling. That's right, we're creating a new educational experience that's more expansive. Shotty, tell them what we got.
Yes, 2023. We got a lot in store, a lot planned for you guys. So you know that EYLU already includes monthly financial planning calls with me, book club calls with Troy, real estate calls with MG the Mortgage Guy, access to the home buying blueprint, volume 1 and volume 2. Part of the revamp will include 27 local chapters from across the United States, live interactive teaching, hands-on, not just pre-recorded videos, plus 15 brand new curriculums.
The biggest just got bigger.
Head over to EYLUniversity.com. That's EYLUniversity.com. See you there.
Working with Mary on the outside, doing some, you know, deals and, you know, opportunities and appearances. You know, I was handling a lot of that part of her business, like appearances with different people around the country, like when she went on tour and things of that nature. And then, I opened a nightclub, so I would have a lot of artists come through the nightclub in Brooklyn. So through my relationships, and then that, I just kept all the entertainment relationships. And then when I opened Brooklyn Chop House is really when a lot of, because it's the same thing that I used to do in the music industry. I used to frequent a lot of these restaurants and do my dinners and my meetings. And that's what we did a lot in the, you know, when, you know, you working, you know, having meetings after you, before you go to the studio or after you leave the label, there's always like, oh, you want to get something to eat? So either the label got the corporate card or you spending the money. So that's how that went. But yeah, the relationships were important, and, you know, just doing good business with people all the way around kind of paid off in the end.
So, all right, you take the steps to open Brooklyn Chop House.
Yeah.
What's the process to do that?
So what happened was Brooklyn Chop House on Nassau Street used to be a Denny's, right? So I got a call from the Denny's owner, like, it's not working out, right? This restaurant's on Wall Street. It's not really, you know, performing the way it's supposed to. If you want to turn it into an IHOP, turn it into a, you know, the landlord is open for you to turn it into an IHOP, because we know you got the rights And, you know, there's not a lot of them in Manhattan. This would be perfect for you. The operationally, the vicinity was perfect. It was right over the bridge. I had one downtown. So I jumped in the deal. And midway through the deal, I said, you know what? This might not be good for IHOP. So if Denny's didn't work, I mean, IHOP's stronger. I don't think I want to, you know, put an IHOP here. So, you know, I told the landlord I want to do my own concept. So originally I was going to do a Caribbean concept there. So I took the lease, I signed the lease, and midway through me developing and building out the restaurant, I call my partner Dave, and I said, hey, you want to, you think you want to do this? And, you know, he's West Indian. You want to do this restaurant with me? Because he always said, you know, when you find an opportunity, just call me. So I called him, and Dave was like, I bet, let's do it. So then we got together, and that's my partner in Chop House. And then what ended up happening was I gave another gentleman, you know, who does operations and who had a restaurant, Stratus, I gave him a walkthrough. Right, I was like, I'm doing this restaurant. It's gonna be this, you know. This is my first foray into, you know, New York City. I'm gonna do like more like a fine dining upscale restaurant. And he was like, oh, that's dope. He was like, you know, you should consider, you know, flipping it and doing, you know, a different concept. I was like, yeah. He was like, yeah, let's do. You know, I was successful doing these other Asian brands. Let's do, you know, Asian meets steakhouse. And the Caribbean was gonna be partly like a steakhouse anyway. So. I was like, that sounds good. Let's figure it out. So, you know, we came up with the name. You know, the name was always going to be Brooklyn something, right? So we was thinking about Brooklyn Bridge restaurant. We was thinking about Bridge and Butter. We had all these names, and then we just said Brooklyn, and it was like Chop House, like chopsticks and chop steaks. And that sounds like something that's been around for a long time. So we came up with that name, and then that's how Brooklyn Chop House was born.
I was going to say, in terms of, from a financial standpoint, obviously this is Wall Street.
Right.
So we're talking about, are you leasing the spot? How much is it as opposed to had you done the IHOP deal, right? Was it more cash intensive, or were more people needed to be involved to finance it? How did that work?
So it was less cash intensive because the blessing for me and my partner Dave is that we were kind of, you know, successful for what we've been doing for the last 10 years. So I was actually looking for an investment opportunity. And the fact that it's a second generation space, meaning that it was already built out as a restaurant. So I just had to come in and change the furniture, change the equipment, change the aesthetic. You know, so we just had to basically, to use a music term, I had to remix the restaurant, mm-hmm. right? So I put my Diddy on it and changed up everything and made it more upscale, all the textures, all the furnitures, all the, you know, the equipment, and we changed it into our use, mm-hmm. right? So much less cash intensive by doing second generation space. And even if it was IHOP, it probably might even be more or less because a lot of the equipment is the same from IHOP and Denny. They're similar.
Yeah.
You know, I probably would have went with all new equipment because that's how I like to start with, you know, a concept I believe in. So I would have started fresh instead of using old equipment.
Did you have to sign like a 5-year or 10-year lease? What was that process?
Oh yeah, we signed a 25-year.
25-year lease.
Which is unheard of because I talked them into, you know, well, actually Denny's had a great lease. Let me not say that. And then I was able to negotiate a great lease myself. So, we have a long lease.
So, all right. So now the restaurant business is a lot harder than the franchise business because it's not set for you. You got to kind of set it, but you've learned it from, so did you take the principles that you learned from franchise and just duplicate it with the restaurant?
I got to say it to you. Another great question. Yes. So that's how I was able to put systems in place because I was already trained with these systems, right? From food ordering, from all the vendors that I was dealing with, from how the vendors to order from, which is basically automated, right? So we use some of the same vendors, we use some of the same principles from a franchise, I, you know, use the, that's those same principles in Brooklyn Chop House, from hiring, from operations, from scheduling, from all of those different things and all of those different tools that I had at my disposal from being at IHOP, except from, you know, obviously I don't sell pancakes, but but I use, you know, the knowledge that I got from all of the years of operating underneath these proven systems. I employed some of that, especially back at the back end, like the back end, like the financial, the bookkeeping, the, you know, all of those things. So I already had, you know, systems in place from accountants.
Let's talk about some of the stuff, like, all right, like food costs, right? Mm-hmm. Explain what food costs is and why food costs is so important.
Oh, food costs is so important. So food costs and labor costs are your two highest controllables, your two highest controllable costs. So in any P&L, when you're looking at 100%, or you're looking at, let's just say $1. So typically your food costs, you know, can range anywhere from 25% to 35% of that $1, right? So, and that's something you have to control, right? And then you have your labor costs, which can be also high 20s to mid 30s, which if you put the two together, that's anywhere from 55 to, you know, high 60s or 70% of every dollar is in those two controllable costs, right? So food cost is extremely important, because if you can't control the cost of your food, obviously it's going to shrink your margins, mm-hmm. right? You shrink your profit margins. So it's great to have, like, for instance, back to the franchising. So they have, we do what we call, like, bulk purchasing, mm-hmm. right? Because there's so many restaurants purchasing at the same time that it reduces, and it could kind of stabilize, right? You could negotiate your prices and stabilize your food costs, which is to your advantage, because there's a lot of like fluctuation in obviously produce and, you know, chicken and meats and things of that nature. So with having so much buying power, you're able to level that out and control it, like, pretty much to get the maximum out of your food cost, meaning to bring your food cost down, because mm-hmm. the buying power is so much. So it's a little more challenging when you have your own concept, because if you're not doing volume, you're not able to, you know,
get the discount.
Get that discount of that buying power that 1,000 restaurants are buying versus, you know, just a small group of restaurants. And so in the franchise, we have what we call a co-op, who goes in and negotiates the pricing for us, and we're all part of that co-op.
For the whole region.
Oh, yeah, so, correct, for the whole region. So within the country, there might be, you know, 10 co-ops, mm-hmm. right? So every region has their own co-op. So for New York, for example, there'd be New York, New Jersey, Connecticut co-op, right? So we'd go in, might be 100 restaurants, and we, you know, we plan, right? We say, okay, we're going to do this special. Like this, we think this is going to work. This is back to IHOP. So the co-op is an important part of it, but you don't have that in when you own your own restaurant, your own brand. So you have to do the best you can in negotiating your own prices and really watch the food costs, because, you know, it's a small, even though you could do large numbers, your profit is very small in restaurants.
So how do you manage it? Because this is interesting. Like when you're doing pancakes, you can do a different variation of pancakes, right? You can, but they're still pancakes, or right. they're chocolate chip, but you do something special with them. But one of the things, like when we go to Brooklyn Chop House, the menu is so extensive.
Right.
There's so many different types of food. And so, like, one of the things we've heard, especially in the restaurant business, is keep the menu limited. That way you can cut down on the food costs and have higher margins. But you have such a wide variety. How do y'all balance, like, having all that, being an independent, and keeping good profit margins?
I'm about to drop a jewel. y'all going to have to pay me for this one. Y'all have to come see me for this one.
You're going to have to frequent the restaurant.
Yeah, you got to frequent the restaurant. So we use a lot of the same things in different items. So we lose a lot of the same menu items in different dishes, mm-hmm. right? That's kind of how we do it. So if we're buying, you know, Bell and Evans organic chicken, we'll have on our chicken dishes or our chicken and rice or
chicken saute,
Beijing chicken, sweet and sour chicken, chicken kung pao, different menus that we have. We have the same item, so the items aren't that extensive, but we're able to create we're able to create different likable dishes that
offer
people
one item
offer that
so like
one
the lobster
item.
You got the lobster,
so lobster, we have lobster fried rice, we have lobster saute, we have a lobster spring rolls, we have lobster salt and pepper lobster, we have ginger lobster. So yeah, that's enough.
All are good, by the way. I think I've tried everything you just said.
Pick up those gems, ladies and gentlemen. He just dropped them.
Somebody order the lobster.
More lobster. Let's talk about liquor license, because that's something that a lot of people have, I've seen restaurants getting taken out because of liquor license. Like they might lose their liquor license and then they're not making enough money. Mm-hmm. How much revenue, like at percentage-wise, comes from a liquor license, and how hard is it? What's the challenges in actually getting a liquor license and maintaining a liquor license?
So I have quite a few of those, but it's in the city that I operate in, it's not that challenging. You just have to qualify, and you have to qualify in two ways. Your location has to qualify and you have to qualify. So obviously, you know, you couldn't have a license before and do like reckless things with it. You got to be responsible. And then obviously you have to have the capital to build your restaurant, because they want to know that you can actually build a restaurant that you're applying for the liquor license for. And the challenge is sometimes is that, you know, when you're applying for the license, you're actually building the restaurant at the same time. Mm-hmm. So you're actually spending money while you apply for the license. The cost of the license is not a lot of money. It's only $4,500 per bar, right, in New York City. So that's not hard. But finding a location that can be licensed can be a challenge, because the liquor authority don't want too many licenses unless it's zoned differently. Mm. They don't want too many licenses or too much alcohol being sold on the same block.
In one area.
Right. Because
unless it's like Times Square, then it doesn't matter.
Unless it's like a zone like a Times Square or
like Bourbon Street.
Yeah, or things like that, then it's different. Or like Hell's Kitchen has a different zone. But other places, and I'm assuming it's the quality of life, they don't want too many liquor licenses on one block. I believe it's like 4 might be the max or something like that. I'm not sure, but your location has to qualify. So it can't be too close. I think it's the 500-foot rule. You got to be 500 feet away from a school, mm-hmm. A church, and other entities that are in the
like a daycare center,
yeah, things like that. You can't be like, you can't walk out and then there's the nightclub, or you can't walk out then there's, you know, things like that. You're selling the liquor store, so you know they tried to so in that essence, the actual location needs to qualify as well as you qualify when to get the liquor license.
When you created Chop House, obviously, you got to have food costs, but there's also a part of it that you have to market to make sure that people know that it's there. Right. And so I'm wondering, was there a marketing budget, or was it the power of the relationships that you had, you know, cultivated throughout your career that helps inside that marketing?
So it was a combination of both. It's the power of social media, right? So just one person or a few people that influencers, tastemakers, people that just love the brand and, you know, and love what we do. Could we fuse, you know, our, you know, culture, whether, you know, entertainment, music, food, fashion, we kind of fused it together to create Brooklyn Chop House. So when people get that experience, you know, they share it. And once they share that experience, people may say, even today, we're getting a lot of people in Times Square Like, we just came here to see a play and to go to Brooklyn Chop House. So we're getting after you know, being open, the brand being open 5 years, now we're getting people from out of state that's coming in town that they heard about it, or they heard someone celebrated there that was, you know, a significant, you know, person or celebrity or artist or athlete, you know, celebrated at the restaurant, and they see the social media, because it's not really like the news, it's just social, and people posting how much they enjoy their experience, how much they enjoy the food, they're taking pictures of the food, and you know, that's really has what has spread the word around. And the relationships obviously, you know, help. You know, I come from a promotion background, so I used to throw parties as well, like one or two big parties a year. So, you know, I had a small, you know, network of people that came to support, but it's not just that. It's just the brand is standing on its own, and, you know, the experience of when, you know, they come there are the two most important things. Obviously, the food, people like the food, but, you know, you want to have a good experience in a nice place.
Yeah, like I said, you know, they see me there probably at least once a week, so.
Oh, yeah, I'll see
doing my promotional purposes. So let me ask you this. So you said the two biggest costs that you could control are food and labor.
Yes.
We talked about food. Let's talk about labor.
Okay, so labor, you have to be able to control, to schedule correctly, know your market, right? So I don't open for lunch, right? Lunch at one point prior to COVID was a big daytime part, a big segment of the business. But right now it's not as big in certain markets as it used to be, because the traffic isn't the same. The traffic changed.
So people aren't working?
Mm-hmm. People aren't working
remote.
As much.
They're remote.
From the office, maybe it's 3 and 2, right? Or maybe it's all at the, office. So, all at home. So what happens is you have to know your, you know, traffic patterns. You have to know how to schedule. And that's a huge cost, because obviously, you know, there's a lot that goes into labor, and, you know, New York City, you know, requires that, you know, you do it the right way. So, you know, we pride ourselves on having quite a few employees that help us execute. And when you're busy, you need more employees. So, but when you're not busy, there's, you know, some slow times. You have to know how to, you know, control your schedule.
What are some other costs that are associated with the business? Obviously, you said food and labor, but there's other costs that people probably aren't aware of if they're trying to get into the space, that they probably should be aware of and prepare for if they're going to.
Yeah, so I think knowing your location, you know, you heard the term location, location, location. Mm-hmm. Knowing the right location for the concept that you're doing, right? So, for instance, you might not want to open up Subways in your neighborhood when everyone's at work during lunch, right? Because mm-hmm. Subways is primarily a sandwich, is primarily a lunchtime item. So you might want to position your franchise or your brand if you focus on lunch, you might want to put that near an office complex where people are at work, where people need to grab lunch, right? So it's all location, right? So I think that, and, you know, obviously negotiating the deal and, you know, try not to have high rents, which is tough in certain markets. That's a non-controllable cost, because that's a fixed cost, right? So you have fixed costs that you have to obviously be aware of, you know, from garbage to electric to, you know, rent and, you know, cleaning services and things that you must have as far as running a restaurant. So you have the fixed costs, and then you have things that are in your control that you must control, else it hurts your bottom line.
So you got the variable cost and fixed cost.
Yeah.
The
variable insurance you put in there too?
Insurance would be a fixed cost, because you can't control
right
the insurance rates.
I have this picture for you. I'm going to show this to you, right? Because you said people visit. Look at the date. See the date?
Hold on, let me see.
March 3rd, 2020.
Oh, wow, this is right before the pandemic.
A week later, yeah. Brooklyn Chop House would close its doors.
Rap.
So I want to talk about that, man. Talk about, well, March, it was my birthday. So we went there, and this is the down by Wall Street before Times Square. So talk about that, the impact, obviously, that COVID had on you and how you were able to leverage that in the new location in Times Square.
So, I mean, we were all impacted. Like most industries were impacted, especially the hospitality industry, the restaurants and hotels. Everything was just closed. It was just like, it was over. So we all went home. We had to really think, and the word is pivot. We had to really figure out how to pivot from all of this, right? Because you could have sat down and just waited till everyone came back, which in retrospect, it took a long time for it to get back to, it's still not normal, to get back to some normalcy, right? So we had to figure out how to pivot, and that's how, you know, our concept Brooklyn Dumpling Shop was born, from pivoting. That's one thing. And the other thing was we had to change our back to labor. So we had to cut all the labor back, obviously, because we're not open, but we were allowed to do delivery. So our deliveries went up because we got, you know, we had some support. So a lot of people were coming to pick up. So we were doing pickup and deliveries. We were closed. We couldn't do any indoor dining. So our pickup and deliveries went through the roof. And then we started delivering food to the first responders, a lot of emergency rooms, because, you know, at that point, you know, there was a lot of people, a lot of loss of life, and things were happening that, you know, we didn't know what was going to happen next, right? It was just like, oh, you touched this person, it was a weird time. So once we started doing that, we end up getting, you know, someone picked up the story. And I think we got Hero Today, the magazine, in one of the newspapers. And then all of a sudden, the food purveyors, right, which were also, in fact, impacted, they closed because they don't have anyone to send food to but the people that's doing delivery and takeout. So their business changed, and they had a lot of product that they had to, you know, certain things have an expiration date, right? So vegetables and, you know, different things. So all of a sudden, we started getting boxes and loads of vegetables and food and produce because they saw that we were, you know, cooking things and just giving it away, right? So that was great. So the purveyors, you know, Voss Water, different companies just started sending us boxes and packages. Our dining room was filled with boxes of produce, vegetables, water, anything that we could, you know, make. So we'd make all these dishes in pans, and we'd just bring them to police departments, hospital, every hospital in the city, I think we touched, just out of the kindness of our heart. We didn't want anything in return. We just knew at that point it was, you know, people that were on the front lines didn't have to be in the front lines. They could have quit too, right? So we just did something for them. And then when they started the open, the outside program where you could build the decks is when we built the decks. And then from there, everyone, I guess it was cooped up too much. It was looking like Paris outside. Like everybody came out. It was like a outdoor party, like every night.
I remember that, yeah. that element. It was had outside. It was in the winter. They had like heated lamps.
Yeah, I had winter. I had it covered. I had heat lamps. So for just about a whole year till 2021, we was outside. We was rocking outside. It was snowing and people were eating. The decks were full because it became like, I guess everyone's patterns changed again. It became a way of
just getting outside. Life, getting outside. Speaking of your employees, we got to give Jaquan
absolutely
a lot of
dope shout out. He always holds us down every time. Even in Abu Dhabi, he was out there with you guys.
Yeah, so Jaquan, and I'm glad I was able to take him out there and show him, you know, the other side of the world. But yeah, he was with us from, I guess, after the fifth or sixth month of us opening Brooklyn Chop House, FIDI in the financial district. And it's great to see his growth. He's been with me since then, since 2019. So I had the opportunity to do a Brooklyn Chop House with the W in Abu Dhabi during Formula One.
Real flash.
Which was incredible. Bumped into you guys on the other side of the. Not only did I bump into them, I was on a plane with them.
That's a fact.
This is true.
That's a fact.
Going and coming back.
Yeah. By the way, we were on the second floor. In case you don't know what that means.
If you know, you know. Separate entrance.
Yeah, separate entrance. Whole separate entrance. You know?
That's a fact.
Yeah.
And Marsha, shout out to her too.
Yeah, shout out to Marsha, my event manager. She's holding it down.
She's holding me down a few times. So let's talk about the most important part of a restaurant, the chef. Because it doesn't matter the ambiance, the vibe, if the food isn't good. So, you know, I don't think people have a full appreciation of chefs because it's probably one of the hardest jobs because you don't even really live a real life. You're working in a restaurant from like 6 o'clock to like 2 o'clock in the morning, five days a week. It's like a night shift. You don't have nights.
I mean, and weekends. What about
weekends?
What about holidays?
Yeah, exactly.
Like the business is tough. I mean, I've been fortunate to layer all of my businesses with managers and, you know, I'm to the point where I have a director of operations. So, you know, but in the beginning, I was in there like that because I had to watch, you know, it was mostly what I had. I had to make that grow. So in the beginning, you really sacrifice and put a lot of work in. But, you know, going back to what you're saying about the chefs, like they, you know, it's a tough position, right? To execute day in and day out. So shout out to my chef. I'm not going to tell your name because people knowing that, you know, the secret sauce, but shout out to my chef, you know,
he holds me down.
And then I replicate that, right? Because now my chef can't be in two places at another time. So now I train another chef. Then for Abu Dhabi, when we become permanent in the W Hotel, there's going to be another chef. And then I'm building one in Miami, which this chef is going to go down and spend like 2 months. So we're training another chef to hold down the latest restaurant while he goes. So it takes time though. Mm-hmm. I got to do it in steps. But when I get to Miami, he's going to be training.
So it's not necessarily, and I shout out to the chef because obviously it is the chef, but it's the recipe. Because my whole thing is like, if the chef isn't there anymore, will the food still taste the same?
Yeah.
Because of the recipes. Yeah. So you got the chef teaching the sous chefs.
Right.
And then they become chefs and then they teach. So the recipe is the most important thing.
Correct. It's the recipes. And it's the chef too. Yeah. Because it's quality control, right? So it's quality control with the recipes, right? Because you could take the recipe and mess it up. So it's just quality control because there's always, you know, new people that come that we train. So it's about doing it consistently all of the time, right? Just like consistent service, right? It's the consistent quality of the food that helps make everyone feel like every time I go there, the chicken saute tastes the same, the sauce tastes the same. So that's kind of key, you know, for anyone in the restaurant business to have that consistency. Because oftentimes, I'm also the customer. I'm not only the business guy, I'm the customer, mm-hmm. right? So I do this, I go out, right? Like I'm on the receiving end. So sometimes I have good service, sometimes I have bad service. Sometimes I have the places that I love the most. They might be a little off, but I love it so much, I forgive them. And I come back and then they get it together or I make a suggestion. I don't think I ever wrote a bad review in my life, but I just, because I'm a restaurateur, I'll give my, you know, input or constructive criticism on how I feel about something that took place during that experience.
So when you brought up expansion, you talked about seeing us in Abu Dhabi. That was fly. That was fly.
That was amazing.
And obviously you just brought up Miami, but Times Square, when you had the financial district location, how did you know it was time to expand? Was there a number that you said, all right, if we hit this, we can grow? Because Times Square, when we're talking about prime location, it don't get more prime than Times Square in New York. And the fact that, I mean, there's a lot of restaurants there, but the fact that we know the owner of one, it's just like, yo, this is pretty cool, which is why like people go there because they know that there's a chance they might see you. So how did you know it was time to expand and grow into probably the heart of New York City?
So I kind of knew based on the reservations, and people couldn't get reservations in the original one. That was one. So I really knew if I use this theory, right? If 10 people call me and say, oh, I can't book a reservation this time, I don't know everybody in the New York or in the world. That means hundreds of other people can't get it either, right? So I just use the theory that maybe there's a lot more people wanting to come all at the same time, meaning during the evenings on weekdays between, like, you know, 6:30 and 10:30. And that's the time that we're mostly always booked. So I said, you know what? This, when COVID hit, the restaurant that was there in Times Square before they left, the landlord used to have dinner at the other restaurant, and he said, hey, I got something for you guys. So we explored the opportunity, and we said, you know what? This is a little scary. This is huge. It's a big undertaking. So, you know, he said, don't worry. We're going to take it in steps, right? This is what it is now, but this is what we'll do for now. I'm like, word? Okay. Let's sit and let's think about it. You know, we sat and we thought about it, and we said, you know what? Let's take a shot at it, right? Because now is the time, because I don't think I can get that same opportunity now there, because it's, I don't know, if you want to say 70% back or 80% back, now things have changed. So it's about seizing the moment, and everything is like the timing. Mm. The deal was right for that time. So we took it on, and, you know, we opened it, and it became, you know, what it is now, and, you know, one of the largest Black-owned restaurants, I don't know, maybe in the country, certainly I think in New York City. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're just grateful that, you know, we were able to get the prime location, because now we get, you know, a diverse crowd, right, during, you know, pre-theater, post-theater. You know, we got a core crowd during, you know, core hours. And, you know, we have a lot of upstairs. We have a rooftop. We have a private restaurant, you know, two levels below, which we're thinking about doing membership. And then, so we have an event space and a few event spaces in a way within us being a restaurant. Mm. So, you know, we looked at all of those possible opportunities, and it all made sense, because there's a few different revenue streams now in order for us to make it all make sense.
So talk about what's next. You said different revenue streams. So you got the rooftop, then you got the dumpling thing. Yeah. Is expansion, is it's cooking classes.
Yeah, so you know, expanding more on our sister brand, our franchise brand, Brooklyn Dumpling Shop. But that's, you know, franchisees going from franchisee now to me and my partner being franchisor. So that's, you know, basically probably one of the biggest steps that I've taken. And also working on a restaurant in Miami, Brooklyn Chop House. I think the you know, that culture, that, you know, the way Miami, you know, the lifestyle of Miami lends itself to a Brooklyn Chop House type restaurant. So we're going to go there, and then from there we're going to London, and then more than likely Vegas. So those are our next.
And in Abu Dhabi too, huh?
In Abu Dhabi, the license deal with us and the W Hotel should be done, and we should be open again permanently for Formula One.
This year. We should have our own little section.
Yeah.
So
we'll do an official grand opening. That was like the pop up grand opening. Now we're gonna do the official.
A lot of restaurants serve as restaurants and nightclubs.
Yeah.
Especially like up here, there's like this strip where a lot of restaurants open and they close. And I used to notice a cycle where a restaurant would open, and they would struggle. And I always knew that they was just about to go out of business when they start throwing parties.
Right, that's true.
So then the parties is like life support. It gives them energy.
Correct.
And it got them back on their feet. And then what happened? There was a stabbing, a fight, and they lost their liquor license, and then they went out of business.
Right.
So, but like Tao, they throw parties.
Right.
And they haven't had any issue. So
that we know about.
that we know about. Okay. Correct. So
I'll tell you last name.
So what's your thoughts on, because I could see how appealing it could be, but it's also dangerous as well.
Right. I would never do it.
You would never do it?
Ever.
Why?
Because I owned a club before.
So you know what comes with that.
Of course. I had a club in Brooklyn, right? So, and I had a club in Brooklyn.
Enough said.
So I did that part already. So for me, it's about the growth. It's about going into real estate, right? So I have a few real estate developments I'm working on. One specifically in Newark, 120 units that, you know, I'm passionate about, and you know, it's like a legacy play for me. So I'm working on that. So the transition from, you know, like leasing to owning, you know, I own other properties, but just on a commercial side is something that I want to, you know, progress into. So that's the natural progression. Not doing, I rather give another restaurateur the opportunity to run what I had. If it, you know, I haven't, you know, thank God I haven't had this happen to me where I had to give the restaurant to someone else, but I'd rather give it to another restaurateur and give them the opportunity than to turn it into a nightclub. And nothing against nightclubs, because we all go there, we all celebrate. Just for me, you know, that business model is just not for me because of the high liability and of probability of possible things, you know, happening. And, you know, we knock on wood and, you know, pray nothing happen, because anything can happen anywhere. No one is immune to things happening because it's the general public. But we want everyone to have a great time, eat dinner, you know, pregame, have some drinks, and then go to the club or the strip club or the turn up or wherever it is.
Shout out to the ballerinas.
Your heart's desire. You know, again, nothing wrong with them. It's just, we're just going to keep it about the food, the culture, the experience, and having a good time at dinner or lunch or brunch.
There you have it. There you have it, ladies and gentlemen. What's the socials, the website? What's the address, all that stuff?
Oh, definitely. It's at Don Poole Music is, you know, my music, my IG, my Instagram, also at Brooklyn Chop House. If you want to, you know, please follow at Don Poole Music, at Brooklyn Chop House, at Brooklyn Dumpling Shop. Those are the three main tags that, you know, I would like, you know, people to follow to see, you know, everything that's going on. And, you know, if you have any, you know, desire to open your own business, we have franchise opportunities and possible license deals, you know, for Brooklyn Chop House. But again, we're just going to keep it in, you know, control and in a few markets.
Yeah. Yeah, you might see us. You definitely probably will see us at some point if you go to Brooklyn Chop House in Times Square. That is the restaurant that I frequent the most. I'm there very, very often. Whenever I'm in the city, I always stop through Brooklyn Chop House. I get the duck. That's my favorite.
Pecan duck
with the pancakes thing.
Yeah, I'm about
pancakes,
to
That's my vibe.
I tell you, we got all that. We got something for everyone.
Orange chicken's incredible. The salmon we had the other night.
That was new. The lychee martini, you guys make a good lychee martini. That's my favorite drink. Oh,
thanks. And I just want to say organically that I appreciate that, seeing you guys there. This is not set up. We bump into each other, even in my restaurant, outside the restaurant. So thank you. Because organically, I'll just see you guys just having some heat real quick. So thanks for coming through.
And if you're in the New York area, you should also visit. Tell me why y'all sent you.
Make sure you get your assets right. And not acquire too many liabilities.
Matter of fact, when this is airing inside the Brooklyn Chop House, tag us. Let us know.
Oh, they got to show this on all of them.
Oh, this is going to be on blast.
Turn the volume down.
Yeah. There you go.
That's a fact. Troy, housekeeping item?
Yeah, shout out to everybody on EYLUniversity.com. Shout out to all our earners. Shout out to everybody supporting the merch. And everybody out there that is telling a friend to tell a friend about what's happening here at EYL. Well, we couldn't do it without y'all, so love is love.
And I need a hoodie before I leave.
Got you.
Man, love
got
is love,
you.
Man.
Thank you guys for rocking with us. We'll see you next week. Peace.
Peace.
Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get half gallons of delicious Kroger milk for $1.29 each. Then get flavorful Tyson Natural Boneless Chicken Breasts for $2.49 a pound, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.